Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob podcast with These Football Times with me, Aidan Williams, and it's magazine time again, and it's another departure from the club editions for us for something a little different once again. This time we're venturing away from Europe and away from South America too and heading into Africa for the first time with a very special edition of the magazine focusing on Africa's greatest, most iconic forwards, the players who've blazed a trail, captured the imagination, thrilled the crowds. This magazine will be out on the 9th of May, so as usual, it will be undoubtedly selling out quickly, so don't leave it too long. Get your order in. I will remind everyone of that at the end again, I am sure. But before we get into the players featuring in the magazine, let me introduce my fellow co-hosts here to chat about African football with me this evening, about the magazine itself and their articles in it. Firstly, Gary Thacker. How you doing there, Gary?
I'm good, thanks. It's been a lovely sunny day today, so we've been down to the beach and had a walk along the sand in the sun and dipped my toes into this sea. So it's been a lovely, relaxed. It's like bank holiday day today because they have so many bank holidays over in Spain, ridiculous. But had a lovely day, and I'm just going to talk about football. And you know, as you mentioned, a bit of departure for us. This Football Times talk about African players, so it's going to be a fascinating discussion, and the mag's going to be brilliant on it.
And it's always nice to get a reminder of the tough life you've got there, Gary.
Well, I do my best. It's a dirty job, but someone's got to do it.
But yes, looking forward to the discussion. And next, we've also got James Sweeney with us, returning from an absence for a little while from our pods. But it's great to have you back on, James.
Yeah, it's great to be back. It's been a long time coming, and it's actually the first one of these I've done that isn't centred around my beloved Leeds United. So it's going to be a nice break to not have to talk about them for a bit. And yeah, just can't wait to discuss in detail some of the iconic players that we've covered in depth in the mag.
This is good. We can have some positivity instead of what's going on in the league at the minute. And speaking of which, the other co-host with us is Everton's own Paul McParland. How are you doing? How are you doing there, Paul?
Yeah, I think football-wise, things could obviously be a lot better, Aidan. I think, I mean, the last we got on the day with you was when me, you and Matt Jones were discussing Everton's place and calculating where the season may end up for us. I don't think any of us anticipated the Burnley revival, so that's kind of changed the picture somewhat. So it's great to be able to move continents and go to Africa. And I think it's been a brilliant choice to go to Africa because it's an area we haven't really dealt with in depth. And there's so much rich history and football tradition here. And I'm sure we'll bring the listeners' attention to a number of players who maybe are not household names, but whose story merits listening to.
Absolutely. There are some familiar names in the list and there are some less so, certainly, which we can get right into. So the Africa magazine, as we say, it's focusing on the most iconic and greatest trailblazing African forwards. Now, this was a list, a selection, if you like, which caused quite a lot of discussion and debate amongst our group when this magazine was first being discussed a few months back. So the list may not be perfect, but, you know, it'll stir the debate. But let's get through it then. I'll give you the list just as a heads up. So the final list of players featuring in the magazine's articles are Didier Drogba. No surprises for who wrote about that one from this panel. Abedi Pele, which is Paul's. Benny McCarthy, Roger Miller, Kalusha Boualia, Sadio Mane, Mo Salah, Hossam Hassan. Sorry, Mo Salah was James's there. I should mention that. Hossam Hassan, Nwankwo Kanu, Salif Keita, George Weah, Rashidi Yekini, Asamoah Gyan, Samuel Eto'o, and Rabah Majer. Now, what a list. What a list. I'm sure people will have their own opinions of who should or shouldn't have been on there, but that is some depth we're covering there. Gary, a hard list to finalise. I mean, we had quite a few discussions on this, but before we get into the players each of us have written about, what do you think are the qualities that's qualified these players feature in the magazine, and also I guess any that you can think of that should have featured that haven't or could have. Sorry, I shouldn't say should have, should I? Could have.
Well, as you mentioned, it's probably when we were talking about possible subjects for the mag, this is probably the one that has certainly of recent times, the most discussion. People sort of, you know, well, what about the economists, this guy? What about this guy? And then, you know, and I think we sort of discussed then sort of, you know, one per country, and that seemed a little bit insufficient. Then, well, you know, they've got to apply for a European club, otherwise what they don't, and that seemed insufficient. And I think in essence, what, you know, I'm already sort of, you know, typically political way, sort of took a little bit of opinions from everybody to end up with this list. And there are several others. I mean, you know, even in Chelsea, you know, you got players like Kalou, Michael Essien, you know, could be branded as a forward. You know? So, I mean, there's lots of players, like Quinton Fortune, Man United, so many players who you could, that's just off the top of my head there with 2.7 seconds thinking. But I think what we have got is a really good spread. And you've, as you mentioned, Aidan, you know, there's some, you know, absolutely stellar names in there. And there's some that are sort of less well-known. And, you know, as we were just talking before we came on air, all the guys here have sort of pitched in and hands up. You know, there's some players there that we know hardly anything, if anything, about. But one of the beauties of this mag is we're all going to learn from it.
Well, that is absolutely true. It's educational for us doing these ventures as well. Not solely on the ones we're writing, or not solely on everyone else's. It's the whole mix together. We get to learn so much, even the ones that we maybe initially thought were familiar. There's always more nuggets of information there. Now, Paul, coming to you, we're talking about the discussions there. Gary's talked about some of the steps it went through, if, you know, one per country and things like that. We also talked briefly about African players who had represented other nations, and that was sort of discounted as well because they weren't in Africa's name. I guess Eusebio is the most obvious example, but I guess that shows that African players isn't something that's just come along in the last three, four decades at the peak level. I mean, obviously, there's been African footballers all this time, but you know, there's been stars that have come through that just haven't done it in Africa's name all the time.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I know me and you in particular, when we're quite pushing for Eusebio to be featured, because in terms of a footballing pioneer, and you arguably, one thing I would say about all these players on this list is you could say none of them have actually made a major impact in a World Cup competition, whereas Eusebio quite clearly did in 1966. And I think that's still, that might be something we get into as to why such an array of talented footballers have never quite been able to demonstrate their skill at the highest stage of the world game. But yeah, the debates were fascinating. You know, all sorts of names were bandied around. Cannon from Arsenal, obviously, Amakachi from Everton. There was quite a few debates. And I think I agree with the idea of limiting it to one person per country. Otherwise, you know, we could have been over too balanced towards one country as opposed to another. And it was great that we got countries like Zambia brought into the discussion as well, who are not a name that immediately, you know, comes to mind. Who knows? Maybe in a few years' time, we could be discussing the Comoros Islands and their players, you know, given how well they did in AFCON this year. So, yeah, I think it was the debate on the thread about who we picked was fascinating. You know, we all put our case forward as to who should be included. And I just hope that people listen to that, you know, will go away and research some of these players, if you've not heard them before, and find out, you know, more about that. In particular, I still think it's underestimated by lots of people in Western Europe. The hurdles African players have to go through to establish themselves in a top European league. They face all sorts of barriers to progress, all sorts of question marks as their character and temperament. And those that do make the top fully deserve to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. Another one that occurs to me that I don't think ever came into the discussion is obviously a prominent Liverpool goalkeeper of the 80s. He was African as well, Bruce Grobbelaar, wasn't he? But I guess maybe we don't think of him as such. But you know, there's another one who broke through in unlikely circumstances, I guess. But an opener for you, James, as well. Just more in general about Africa, African football. Like, what does Africa, African football mean to you? Like, what's the sort of essence of African football, or how that comes over to you?
I think that it's something I'm lucky in my generation, because, like, post Roger Miller is sort of my experience of football. So African nations have always been prominent and significant parts of all the World Cups and in the domestic leagues that I've been, you know, privy to watching live. It's just, I think that it's even now, it's maybe underappreciated the level of, it's probably, and this probably goes down to the fact, going back to an earlier point made regarding their lack of, you know, final success or you know, advanced stage success in the international tournaments, because their impact on the major domestic leagues, especially the Premier League, you only need to look at some of the strikers included in this magazine, is it competes with Europe and South America in many ways. And I think there is a certain, there's a certain type of player that immediately springs to mind from, I suppose, from my childhood and some of the players in there, of like a free-spirited maverick style of a JJ Okocha type of players. The immediate, those sort of, that Nigerian Olympic team will be the first thing that comes to mind when I think of African footballers. But really, across the field, from your sort of world-class midfielders like your Michael Essien's in my time, through the strikers, they've just been a constant source of quality.
Yeah, absolutely. This magazine's been restricted to forwards, but as you say, there could have been so many more if we'd expanded that out. Probably a necessary restriction, otherwise we'd never have got anywhere. Now, okay, let's delve into some of the articles then. Paul, I'll come to you first on yours. So you've written about Abedi Pele, Ghanaian hero of Marseille, one of the first African players to make a significant impact on the European club scene, if we forget about Eusebio a while before. What drew you in this instance to Abedi Pele?
Yeah, mainly because he, in terms of African football, he was the first name I was really familiar with, and particularly after his success with Olympique Marseille in the Champions League. So I really want to find out a lot more about him. In particular, how did he get that name? Because that's a bit of a weight to put on somebody, isn't it? If you endow with the surname Pele. So and I was just fascinated by this guy's life, because it took him so long to get to a top European club. He kind of had to go all around the houses. Now, he starts off with Real Tamale United in his home country of Ghana. He then moves to outside in Qatar. He then goes to FC Zurich. And when he's in Qatar, he has a career-threatening injury that the owner actually pays for to send him to go to Toronto to revive his career, because without that, he wouldn't have a career. You know, he then goes to a team in Benin, AS Dragons. He comes back to Ghana, and he's 22, and it looks like his team's going nowhere. And then suddenly he starts contacting French agents, and he often says in interviews to kids about the importance of learning a language at school, because he said he was trying to liaise with agents in France. He didn't speak a word of French. He was really regressing not having listened to his French teacher in the lessons, and he really struggled to try and adapt to that as well. And even when he made it to France, he had a trial with, I think, with FC Nantes, about which there's very little you can find. Had a trial with Saint Etienne, and a couple of their fan sites are really full of regret that they didn't take the chance on him, because they felt he would have made a real difference to that team at that stage in that period of the club's history. And then he ends up going to the little-known team of FC Niort, who'd actually seen him play in a trial match for Saint Etienne, and suddenly starts to rebuild a reputation there and gets some promoters. Suddenly he's on the radar again, but ends up his agent falling out with the club chairman, and then he ends up being loaned out to Mulhouse, who are also the division below, the one Niels has just been promoted to. And so just when it seemed like his career was going to be stalling a little bit, you then find the situation whereby suddenly AS Monaco and Olympique Marseille are really interested in bringing him to either of those two teams. And I know this is quite a familiar story now, but and whether it's true or not, I don't know, but I really, it's such a good story, it has to be true, doesn't it? But apparently, Bernard Tapie, who is renowned for his negotiating skills in either a positive way or a negative way, when he knew AS Monaco were trying to sign Abedi Pele, he contacted Abedi Pele and told them, look, refuse to take a blood test because they're being prejudiced against you because you're African. They don't need blood testing African players. They won't blood test Western European players. At the same time, he contacts a friend he knows on AS Monaco's board and tells them that Marseille turned down Pele because he's got AIDS. So when Pele turns up for the medical and refuses to have a blood test, AS Monaco thinks, yeah, it's true, he's got AIDS, we can't sign him. And because of that, sort of deft of hand by Tapie, he ends up going to Marseille, which is just an absolutely incredible story. And even now, Pele himself says although it was an underhand way of acquiring his services, he understood why Tapie did it, and he doesn't hold any grudges against him for that. And even that at Olympique Marseille, his career didn't take off there particularly well. Yeah, he found himself not getting a first team place. He mentions he was the victim of appalling racism from some of the senior players. Some horrible comments were made to him on the training ground, And he was desperate to get out. So he then goes to Lille on loan. And the deal is at the end of the season, Lille had the option to buy him. Of course, come the end of the season, he'd been a big success at Lille. I saw on one of their fan sites that they said Abedipelli was the best player we've seen on our pitch since alongside Eden Hazard. They're the two best we've ever seen. So that's kind of high praise indeed. And he was all ready to sign, except Bernard Tapie comes in again and says the deal can't go ahead unless Marseille sign their part of the contract. So he's left in limbo. Tapie goes to the French FA, as do Lille, to try and keep it. It drags on for a couple of months, and the outcome is the French FA rules in favour of Lille. He stays there for another season, but Tapie doesn't give up that easily. Brings him back to Marseille the following season. Once again, struggles to make an impact under Franz Beckenbauer, but once Ramon Gonzalez takes over as the team manager, his career goes into the stratosphere. He gets to the Champions League final in 92, where they lose. He goes back again in 93, where they beat AC Milan. He makes a massive contribution to the winning goal by earning the corner of Paolo Maldini and then taking the corner himself for the team to win 1-0. And suddenly, he becomes the face of African football. He becomes the pioneer of African football, the first native African to win a European Cup final for his team. And you can't underestimate the impact that had in terms of perceptions of other European teams who maybe were a bit reluctant to take a gamble on an African player, thinking there were questions about whether they were suited to European football or not. He absolutely proved them wrong. And there's no argument for saying his success opened the pathway for other footballers from the continent to follow in his footsteps. Now, this is 30 years ago, 1992. When you think about it, it's incredible that it took an African footballer that long to make it on the major European stage. But he did, and his influence lives on. And of course, the story of what happened to Marseille is all well documented. He then moved on to play for Torino in Italy, where he won the award for the best foreign player. He signed for 1860 Munich, but allegedly he thought he signed for Bayern Munich. He was quite disappointed when he realised he signed for the wrong team, and then eventually called time in his career. So it's a fascinating life. And then his legacy lives on because his two children, because his surname is actually Ayew. So his two children are Andre Ayew and Jordan Ayew, who played in the Premier League now for a number of seasons. And the story of how he got the name Pelé is quite bizarre as well, because he was nicknamed that as a kid growing up. And when he applied for his first passport, the head of the Ghanaian FA asked him, "What do people call you?" He said, "Everyone calls me Pelé." He said, "Right, that's your name on your passport." So that's how he ended up being called Andre Pelé. So it's a fascinating history, fascinating story. And I think alongside the other people we're going to talk about tonight, there's so much of a backdrop to these footballers. There's so much going on behind the scenes. There's so many struggles they have to get through to make it to the top. But I think if you're looking at who's arguably the first pioneer to make it through, I'd say there's a strong case for saying Abedipelli.
Wow, fantastic stuff. Now, I think struggles and pioneer is going to be a recurring theme through various things, but I think you're absolutely right in terms of top-level elite European club game for that breakthrough. And it seems incredibly late for it to happen when you think of some of the players, doesn't it? I mean, James, coming to you there, Paul mentioned various things which could be seen as prejudiced or preconceived ideas and issues there that might be part of the problem. Do you think this is in part behind a lot of the struggles of African players? I mean, Paul talked about the circuitous route that Abedipelli had to go through to get to France and get to professional football in Europe. That kind of barrier, and obviously it doesn't exist in the same way at all now. Is it sort of old prejudices, old ideas, do you think, are the reason behind this?
I think that's definitely played a huge part in it. And I think in many ways it's a societal issue as much as it is a footballing issue. And that kind of... the prejudices that were there obviously were the reason why a lot of these players weren't really seen at the top level of Europe. But then by the same token, there's almost a sporting prejudice from these players not being seen at the highest level, which is why I think that when you've got on the World Cup, you've had players like Miller and Sapur seen as pioneering, but what Paul was saying about Abedipelli actually doing it for Marseille, who was probably, you could make a strong case of being the best team in Europe at the time, is it breaks down a barrier for European clubs to, I don't even want to say take a gamble, but bring these type of players in and believe that they're going to be, you know, do the goods for them at the top level.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Gary, it was a hell of a team, that Marseille side, wasn't it? You know, this is players such as Papin, Boxic, Waddle, of course, Desailly as well, and Abedi Pele fit right in amongst them. And that says a lot about the calibre of him as a player, doesn't it, to fit into such a elite team as that one really was.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as you mentioned, I think that a lot of the people who talk about it on the pod tonight and in the magazine will have a similar story to what I Paul just described for Abedi Pele in his starting out in his career. And I think, you know, there's lots of contributory reasons for that. And, you know, for a guy to get to that level, European champions, you know, it not only speaks great heights for his talent, but also for his dedication and commitment and, you know, refusing to stay, just to accept sort of hurdles that are put in his way. And I think, you know, a lot of African players have had a similar sort of experience and, you know, I say it's the great credit that they got through. And you do have to wonder, though, how many potentially other world stars have fell by the wayside because they didn't get the break that these guys got, or they didn't have the fortitude that they had to keep going when the doors get slammed in the face all the time. So, yeah, I mean, these guys, you need, in most walks of life and sports particularly, you need pioneers to open the pathways for other people to follow down.
Yeah, very much so. Well, speaking of pioneers, so there's parallels between the breakthrough we've been talking about there with Abedi Pele and the players I've written about in the magazine as well. They were sort of pioneers of the 80s and early 90s as well. So if you'll indulge me a little bit, I'll prattle on about those briefly. So firstly, there is Kalusha Bwalya of Zambia. Now, this is someone who probably isn't that familiar to many of the people listening and who will read the magazine. But it's an absolutely fascinating tale. And he was a pioneer for African football as well, although less known or more outshone, I guess, by others at a similar time frame. It was a story, triumph and tragedy, really. You know, he made one of African football's big international breakthroughs. But it was away from the glare of the World Cup. So this was in the 1988 Olympic Games in Seoul. He inspired a 4-0 win for Zambia over Italy in that competition. Now, okay, so this is the Olympic Games. It's not a World Cup. It doesn't have the same attention. It doesn't have the same first-choice players. But he scored an incredible hat-trick in this match against Italy, each goal magical in its own way. And yeah, sure, maybe it's not a full-strength Italian side, but it was an Italy side that featured many stars of the future. The hat-trick he scored came against Juventus's Stefano Tacconi. Defence featured Ciro Ferrara, Mauro Tassotti. There was also De Agostini in there, Cannavale up front. This was no amateur team, to put it that way, from the Olympic days. You know, this was a strong team that Zambia took apart. And they did. They simply destroyed them. And Bwalya was at the heart of that. Now, I remember this distinctly from being a young lad watching these Olympic Games. I remember the news it made. But as ever with the Olympic cycle, you know, the news moves on rapidly. And it got overtaken by, you know, Ben Johnson and all that kind of stuff, which became bigger news, of course. But it did cause a splash. And it was an international breakthrough. Now, this was internationally, you know, is an extra step on the recognition, if not as well remembered as those that came in the World Cup before it and after it. While your star obviously didn't quite rise to the extent Abedi Pele's did in Europe in terms of the club game, but he did get a club career in Europe, in France as well, as one of the very few Zambians playing in Europe. And that meant that he was not on a flight 5 years later, 1993, when almost all of the Zambian national team was killed in a plane crash just off the coast of Gabon. They were on their way to a World Cup qualifier in Senegal. Now, Bwalya and one or two other European-based players were making their own way there from Europe. And that is what saved their lives. It's incredible, really. This was a Zambia team that had built from that core of the 1988 and were on the verge of qualifying for the 1994 World Cup. They very nearly did anyway. They narrowly missed out to Morocco, I think it was, in the end. So, you know, Zambia's footballing history could have been utterly different. Walia's personal history obviously took another turn at that point. So instead of just merely being the footballing star, he now became a symbolic representation of a generation lost and its rebirth. As he himself described, their dreams are now our dreams. It's all still very, very symbolic and very, well, very, very tragic. And Zambia, like I say, nearly made it to that World Cup. And if they had done, it would have been a team that they quickly put together from Zambians based abroad or second generation immigrants and so on from around the world that they hastily put together and so nearly got them there. And his career didn't even stop on the playing front. He became an administrator, became chief of the FA. He was then instrumental in bringing in Hervé Renard, the French coach, who subsequently led Zambia to their African Cup of Nations triumph only a few years back. So this is someone who's been in there, instrumental in everything positive and indeed the worst negative of all about Zambian football there throughout. And he's very much at the core of their story, but he's equally an African pioneer, just wasn't quite in the full glare of a World Cup, but it was still a hugely significant breakthrough, given that it wasn't just a sort of narrow victory, it was an absolute mauling, and he was at the heart of that against a strong Italy. But to move us on to another pioneer, I also
I didn't know much about this guy, and I did my research this morning about him, and he was nominated for the World Player of the Year in 1996, for World Player of the Year, and he finished 14th, but this was, we'll talk about pioneers here, this guy was the first player to be nominated for World Player of the Year that hadn't played for a European club in that year.
Yes, I think he was in Mexico by then, I think.
Yeah, right. What kind of recommendation is that? Wonderful. So, you know, pioneer, there you go.
Yeah.
That's
spot on. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Can I just ask, what brought about is it his move to Mexico?
I think that was very much in the twilight years by then. Yeah. You know, he never hit the top clubs in the way that Abedi Pele had. So a bit more bounced around. I think his career was on the wane in terms of his ability to contribute at the top level by then. But he extended out for several more years. And in fact, he claimed those years in Mexico as the happiest of his career. He enjoyed his football there the most. And I guess that's what's shown in how he played and ended up with this nomination.
I was going to say as well, I think although he didn't have the career in Europe that Abedi Pele had, he still, if you actually look at his time at PSV, he joined in the last season of Hiddink's treble winning, it was 2 years after the treble winning team, but that was still an absolutely phenomenal team, and he actually played an attack with Romario. There was still the nucleus of that team, likes of Lerby from the great Danish side, like Eric Goretz in that team as well. I think Kobe Coleman had gone by that point, but he'd still been a big part of the Hiddink team and actually played in Bobby Robson's title-winning teams as well until he departed for Mexico.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely right, James. A slightly paler comparison to Abedi Pele's, but yeah, it's still a strong team he joined. It was only a couple of years after their European Cup win that he joined them. He forged a very strong career, and it is bizarre that he's barely heard of and barely known. And yet, you know, he had quite a significant impact, but I guess arguably not quite as much impact as the other guy I wrote about, which is Roger Miller, the Cameroonian star of the 1990 World Cup. Now, you know, this was an incredible one to write. His tale is obviously much more familiar in terms of what happened internationally. But it was a weird one to write because for someone who really hit the headlines in 1990, I know, obviously, he'd been in the 82 World Cup as well, but, you know, he really became a world star in 1990. The story that I was writing about began in the 60s when his playing career began. I mean, that's just astonishing to me to think that someone who became a world star in 1990, their playing career began in about 67 or 68. But that just tells you he was 38 when he became a global star at the 1990 World Cup. And it's an absolutely phenomenal story. I mean, he's another one who bounced around in France as well. He was best at home in Corsica playing for Bastia in the early 80s as well. But again, never quite made the full breakthrough to the very top levels. He'd been part of a strong Cameroon generation. You know, the 82 World Cup, they went unbeaten and were only knocked out by Italy on goals scored, not even goal difference. That's the Italy who went on to win the World Cup, of course. He won a couple of African Cup of Nations, became African Footballer of the Year a couple of times, but it was at the age of 38, whilst in semi-retirement on the island of Reunion. He was called up by the country's president to join the squad. And, well, the rest is history. I mean, what a superstar he became. He didn't actually start any of the games in 1990, which, again, that's bizarre that he becomes such a star of the tournament and never even started a game. If there's one thing sort of summed up him, other than his wiggling celebration, which obviously was just magnificent and repeated by various other players, the sight of him warming up at the side of the pitch on the track in Naples when in the quarterfinal against England, the mere sight of this 38-year-old semi-retired footballer warming up at the sideline struck fear into the hearts of any Englishman watching. It was incredible to think that those circumstances came together to strike fear into England, who were winning at the time. And yet it did. And then he came on and he turned the game and set up one and earned a penalty for the other. It's just absolutely remarkable what he achieved. And then obviously 4 years later, he went and did it again, slightly less dramatically. But I think in terms of impact, to me, he is the biggest African breakthrough star in terms of global attention. Now, that's slightly different to what Paul's talking about breaking through at the elite level. I don't think, certainly at that time, any other African footballers had the impact Roger Miller's had in terms of acceptance of African football, in terms of additional places at a World Cup tournament. They instantly went up to three places for 1994, even though there was no expansion of the number of entrants. That was in recognition of Cameroon's achievements, which were largely down to Miller. I think the impact he had in that Italian summer is resonated far bigger. I mean, it's odd to think, because there've been other hugely breakthrough moments before. You know, you can cite 1982, Algeria beat West Germany. In 1986, Morocco won their group in the World Cup ahead of England. They were just unlucky to run into West Germany in the next round. These were huge, huge moments, but they didn't seem to get or to cause the rethinking in people's perception and people's minds about Africa and African football. It was, you know, maybe they were seen as anomalies or weird occurrences, and yet it seemed to keep happening and keep happening, but still nobody believed. Still, they were all thought of as minnows and still assumed that everyone would beat them. Now, my question here then, Paul, I'll come to you on this. So I've talked about an impact in the Olympic Games and talked about another in the World Cup. You know, these other achievements, Algeria in 82, Morocco in 86, and then Cameroon in 1990, where does Zambia's 1988 win over Italy sit amongst all that?
Well, I think you led us down quite an interesting speculation here, Aidan, in terms that that team in 1993 that was wiped out on the plane crash, and whether that team stayed together. If they had qualified for the 1994 World Cup, it would have been fascinating to see how they progressed in 1994 and whether they would have made an impact on the world stage. And I think your point about the Olympics is really valid, because I definitely think for lots of us growing up who watched football at that time, the Olympics was like the first time we got to watch, apart from the World Cup, the first time we got to watch African nations playing at a high level in a major competition, because at that time, the 80s, there wasn't the wall-to-wall TV coverage we get now. So a lot of these players you'd read about in world soccer, you couldn't get a clip on YouTube about, because YouTube didn't exist. So this was a chance for these players to make statements about their skills and to make a name for them, and with the view of potentially attracting, you know, a suitor from Europe. Yeah, and for Roger Miller, I mean, everyone remembers Roger Miller for that 1990 World Cup. I mean, the impact the guy made, the story behind the impact, it's almost like a fairy tale. As they say, you've got this guy who quite clearly didn't spend 24 hours a day working out in the gym, lumbering up on the touchline, ready to come on. But the English players, because of his reputation and because he knew what he could do, his unpredictability, were absolutely thrown to a state of panic. And, you know, on a different day, you know, I think, you know, if we hadn't got that third goal to put us ahead and they'd gone to a penalty shootout, you know, you just imagine how that might have turned out, given our record of penalties. So, yeah, it was that 1990 World Cup. I mean, I think I'd argue as well that might be one of the first times that I know, for when I was working in schools at that time, that in the playground on the weekend after World Cup games, people were doing a Miller celebration in the playground, which they'd never really done before. So it kind of gave you an idea of, you know, what the impact had been. And I suppose the frustrating thing is, you know, which we can't just want the stars here, no, Cameroon did so well in 1990. No other African team, I don't think, has got beyond the quarterfinals in the World Cup since then.
No, there's two others that have done it. I think it's Senegal
and Ghana.
Yeah.
And you just wonder why that is, you know. And part of me sometimes looks at the coaching, and I always have a concern that, you know, lots of African countries with huge potential tend to appoint these aging European coaches who weren't particularly successful in Europe, but are given the major job of seeing the team through a major competition. And they tend to go for old hands rather than young, up-and-coming managers from the continent. So I think that that's also another debate here. You know, for African football to move on, do we now need these players who we're talking about here to come through and be the next generation of African coaches to move the game on for them?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I guess look at the Senegal team now. They're one of the few who do have a coach from their own country, don't they? Their former player from their own golden generation, I guess, the 2002 side, is now coaching them. So, yeah, it's an interesting point. Now, Gary, coming to you, with regards to Roger Miller, has there ever been a more unlikely World Cup hero? You know, this is quite something, isn't it? And as a follow-up to that, would Cameroon's breakthrough in 1990 have had the same impact it did without Roger Miller? Or, I guess, would they even achieved it without him?
I think the impact Roger Miller had is sort of more than the goals he scored. It's the personality he was, the age he was, and the situations where he came on to change the games. And, you know, I think for every sort of frustrated late 30, 40-year-old dad who still thinks he's got the magic in his feet but had never had the break, then this guy was the inspiration until he started doing the dad dance in the corner flag. And then you're thinking, well, perhaps not so much sunshine. I think he made a massive impression in that tournament, but not only for his, what he did on the pitch, for what he sort of represented off the pitch as well. But, you know, you might be 38, you may not have been, you know, the sort of fittest guy in the gym, but you can still make an impact in massive football matches. And I think he did add to the romance of Cameroon. I mean, we're talking about, you know, a team that, in the first game against Argentina, you know, it was brutal. There was nothing particularly enchanting about that. But I mean, this guy made Cameroon probably, you know, it's like when Keegan was at Newcastle, Newcastle was his second favourite club, and you know, when Miller was playing for Cameroon, Cameroon were his second favourite team in the World Cup. So I think there's many sort of layers to his the impact that he had.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, people of my generation still just fondly recall Cameroon, you know, all these decades on, because of the impact they had. And you want them to do well, even though they never quite lived up to that again. Now, James, both Boalia and Miller, and I guess others who were in the magazine that we haven't mentioned, like Lakhdar Belloumi of the 82 Algeria team, and I guess Pelé as well, and George Weah, I guess, comes soon after that. They paved the way for so much of what followed. Now, as the 80s and I guess the early 90s went on, the evidence was mounting, as we said, for the strength of African football, the abilities of their best players, and so on. But as I said, the prevailing attitude still largely remained until 1990, until this Cameroon achievement. You know, prior to then, they were still minnows, no hopers. Why did it need, do you think, such a seismic World Cup achievement for the world to actually take note?
I think it's just the sheer scale of the exposure in the World Cup. It's the biggest occasion of football for the most hardcore fan to the casual person that watches football once every 4 years. And I think that while there were pioneers and great players before Miller, it was more of a revolution or a trailblazing moment in the psyche of people of what an African player could be, rather than them breaking any new ground in terms of in terms of what he was doing on the pitch. And I think that the biggest achievement you can say about Miller's legacy is that while there was a sort of a folktale novelty to what he was doing in the eyes of many people in the 90 World Cup, now there's an expectation. It's not met with an exotic sort of sideshow feel. You expect the best African strikers to be a serious threat in the competition. And you expect, while it's probably a stretch to say that there's been an African team that's been in among the favourites at this point to win a competition, there's any of the major African teams are going to be taken seriously by any of the major European or South American teams. And it was probably the moment of Miller warming up on that touchline against England, particularly in England, and the fear being stricken into the hearts of English fans, that's a watershed moment. You don't go back from that. And it can't really be overstated. The impact he's had on the outlook as much as anything.
No, absolutely right. Absolutely right. Well, speaking of best African strikers, let's bring us headlong into the 21st century now, Gary. And I think we could all easily have predicted which great African striker you would have picked to write about. I take it your choice was an easy one?
Well, it was. When we set on the issues and I wanted to do a drug, but I had a conversation with Omar first because I wanted to write a different account. I didn't want to write this guy was a great player and scored lots of goals for different teams and all this. I wanted to write about the man and what he did off the pitch as well as on it. There was a lot of similarities in Aidan talk about Abidi Pele, and Drogba had a sort of similar difficult childhood. He went to live with his uncle and aunt in France because his parents both lost their jobs and they were sort of struggling financially. Then he managed to get back because he was homesick, got back to Cote d'Ivoire. And then we went back to France afterwards, and lived in Paris for a while and had a chance to go to PSG. But PSG was sitting in this room with him with the contracts, and then said, we've got to go to discuss something. Basically left him in the room. They just walked away, and he had to sort of beat the disappointment he had. And when we flew back to England in February because we couldn't go because of the COVID previously, and my son had bought me Drogba's autobiography, which is actually called Commitment. And it's a really good description of his life. And he sort of persevered through sort of disappointments and injuries and went to and then Guingamp, but he played with Malouda, who came to Chelsea afterwards, and before he ended up at Marseille. And then obviously moved to Chelsea. But as I said, I didn't want to focus on just, this guy had a transfer here and he played well here and scored goals. He also is massively he loves his country massively, and there was a couple of instances I want to just mention. They were qualifying, they played the last qualifier for the World Cup qualifier. There's a tragic civil war going on in Cote d'Ivoire, which had been going on for, there's a Muslim north and a Christian south, and they've been in dispute for, it's been a sort of a war that kept flaring off and going down and flaring up again. Really, really sort of difficult times for the country, and they qualified for the tournament. And I can't remember what it was. It might have been Algeria. I can't remember. They played the last game away from home, and they were celebrating in the dressing room. And at the end of each game, he got the players to go to pray for peace for the country. And the television, the Cote d'Ivoire national television, were sort of filming them celebrating. And he called for quiet in the dressing room, and he fell on his knees and begged the Cote d'Ivoire people to stop fighting each other. And this guy basically stopped a civil war after going back. And he had the sort of, he used his celebrity status to influence the government to move an international, I think it was an African Cup of Nations qualifier from the south, where it's normally played in the capital, to the north, the Muslim held north, the rebel held north. And there were soldiers from the south and the north sitting next to each other in the stand. The elected president, the rebel leader, sitting next to each other in the stand. Amazing situation, apparently. And also afterwards, he sort of used his financial earnings to, he wanted to build a hospital in Cote d'Ivoire. But then he was advised not to because the building is fine, but get the building done, but where are the doctors? You know, where's the admin? Who's going to pay for the running costs? So instead, what he did was he basically took the hospital to the people and he built lots of smaller health centres around the country. And this is the part of the Drogba Foundation is still going strong and doing such things. He went to Shanghai, Genoa, after Chelsea, and donated his earnings to these great causes. And I didn't want to write the article in that sort of theme, and then I must have, it's a bit off track here. Bless his cotton socks. He was sort of, yeah, it's great to do that. So that's what I did. And, okay, this is a guy who scored magic goals for Chelsea. And his last kick as a Chelsea player before, actually, though he did return later, was to secure the Champions League for us in 2012 with that penalty. So, I mean, I don't want to belittle his football achievements, but on a wide scale, what he did off the pitch was so much more worthy.
Oh, absolutely right. And I think that it's great how you've described it there and how you've pitched the article that way and focused it that way, because I think it brings so much more depth to it all, doesn't it? It makes it, yeah, adds to the story.
Yeah, I'm sure there's lots of other African players who have done. I know Mane does a similar sort of thing, a Liverpool player, and I'm sure others do too, but somebody has to start the ball rolling, the metaphorical football rolling, must make the first pass, as it were. And, Drogba, because of his status as, anyone African player of the year, and he's won top Premier League titles, FA Cups, European Cups, League Cups, all those sort of. But he says his greatest achievements were to stop the Civil War in his own country. And he was invited, a player was also mentioned in the magazine, George Weah, after playing in the camera, elected to president of Liberia. And Drogba was sort of, he'd had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission based on the South African principle after the war. And the one person that wanted, both sides wanted on this commission was Drogba, because he hadn't got a political affiliation either side. And he was sort of been encouraged to stand for president. He would have won the polls, and he would have won by a mile. But he didn't want to be associated as a politician with an agenda. He wanted to be associated as a person, as a coach, as a Cote d'Ivoire, as an Ivoire, a member of Cote d'Ivoire population, should we say. It was to be a representative of the people, not a politician. And that's what it did.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's remarkable achievement, but I guess none of it would have been possible without his footballing talents gaining him that fame and notoriety and celebrity. So, it goes hand in hand, doesn't it? But Paul, I mean, Drogba, as Gary's told us there really, really well, he's obviously more than simply a footballer, isn't he? It shows massively the sort of power of football and the impact that one individual who happens to be supremely talented at a relatively trivial matter can have on the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating story, that guy. The whole thing about moving that qualifying game to the north of the country to bring the two warring sides together. And I'm sure that was taken with a degree of risk to himself, because it could have gone badly wrong. So the fact he's prepared to take that gamble and rely on the fact that his name and the fact he wasn't associated with any political affiliation could make such a difference to his country. I think it's a fabulous story, and I agree with you. I think it's easy to write a story about a footballer's goals and medals and honours, but sometimes you want to dig deeper. What type of person is this guy? What's his influence outside of football? And you kind of wonder as well, we've kind of had this debate before about the tipping of footballers in the UK, that very few UK footballers make that move into politics and changing government policy. I think Marcus Rashford is the first one to do so in my memory. And there's Didier Drogba and George Weah as well, who've used their fame to give something back to the country and have just acted as an inspiration. I just think that's such a heartwarming story. And honestly, I'm sure if Drogba was Ukrainian, he'd be over there now sorting things out between the two warring factions, because I just think it just shows the power of personality when you've got somebody who clearly doesn't have a political ideology, but clearly has the respect of the nation, who can just bring the warring factions together. And also, it's another example of the of the healing power of football, that you can have a divided country, but when it comes to a major competition, everyone joins together to support the team and differences are forgotten. So yeah, it's a fantastic story and I can't wait to read it.
Now, James, like I say, this wouldn't have been possible without his football ability. So yeah, briefly to talk about Drogba as a footballer, do you think he revolutionised the striker's role to some degree? I think, you know, prior to him, strikers were sort of the goal poacher style, you know, that kind of goals was literally all they did in a lot of cases. Whereas after him, through Drogba, he became sort of the all action. He could do a bit of everything. He was involved everywhere. It went from strike partnerships to lone strikers, and you know, he could do it all himself, score all the goals, and contribute in other ways. Am I sort of reading too much, or has he completely changed how we see strikers and what we expect of them?
I don't think you're reading too much at all. I think he was one of the key players in that era to redefine the position in a way that's still telling to this day in how number nines play. I had the pleasure of writing about Drogba for the Marseille magazine a couple of years ago, about his time, his solitary season at the Velodrome, which left a huge legacy impact on him as a person, but also he became a bit of a cult, well, more than a cult hero, a bit of an icon there. What's interesting about him as well is the hardships in his career. Like, you look at it at 20 years old, when he was playing for Le Mans, he was on an apprentice's contract when he got the leg break, which kept him out for the best part of 2 years. And at that point, if you think back, like by France 98, you look at strikers of a similar age. Ronaldo was 21. Thierry Henry played that final. He's 20. Ronaldo's had an ascendancy to stardom and about to have a demise and another ascendancy. Thierry Henry's about to win a World Cup. He still hasn't got a professional contract. So then I think he was a prolific striker. There's no doubt about that. Maybe when you look at his goal record with the absolute elite, other elite Premier League strikers, it isn't that impressive. Like, you look at his famous partnership with Frank Lampard. Frank Lampard, the midfielder, got the majority, the lion's share of those goals. But there was more to Drogba than that. He had a tireless style. He was well versed in the dark arts. He was an absolute nightmare to mark. He was strong. He had every aspect of his game as well as goals. And it's now we, with front threes being this sort of prevalent at the top of the top of the European game, you'll often get, you know, what the wide players contributing more, and the number nine, if you like, being the workhorse. But Drogba was that, but he was also deadly and the ultimate big game player. His good, like his record in finals is absolutely ridiculous. Obviously, the Champions League equaliser against Bayern in the dying embers is the main one I can see Gary celebrating there. But there were so many. I think got 9 final goals in total for Chelsea, and I think it was 12 in 15 appearances throughout his career. So he was, yeah. He not only was he an absolutely outstanding player, but he certainly went a long way to redefining the position.
Oh, magnificent. Well, let's move things even closer to the present day, or in fact, entirely to the present day. And we'll stick with you, James, here, because you've been writing about some of Liverpool's finest. Now, Liverpool's home to not just one African superstar at the moment, but 2, Senegal's Sadio Mane and Egypt's Mo Salah. Of course, they shared the starring role on Merseyside lately. Sorry, Paul. And also in terms of African international football in recent times, of course, you know, the recent AFCON final and the World Cup playoff that they both squared off against each other in. Now, James, you've written about Mo Salah from these two. So what is it about him that appealed to you? And was this the one you were hoping to get to write about?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, there's absolutely loads that I would have had that I would have been absolutely thrilled to write. What I liked about this, it was the first one, maybe ever, no, I think, barring F, Federico Chiesa, it's the first one I've written for the print magazine that's covered a player that's, you know, at the peak of their powers, arguably right now. And I think you could make an argument that he might be the first African forward, I would say since George Weah, who you can make a legitimate claim of being the best player in the world right now at the current time. So it was great to delve into his career. And like Drogba, and like many of the greats we've covered in the magazine, it is a story that sits in the rags to riches genre, if you like. It was a story that started in poverty, and it's a story that has resulted in a lot of giving back, where he's not forgotten his roots, and there's been a lot of, I don't know if I'd call it political intervention, but certainly a lot of societal and financial intervention to help his hometown. So he was born in a small village, Negrig, near the north city of Bassoun in North Egypt. And like many kids his age, he was football mad, constantly playing street football with his friends and his brother, and trying to emulate his heroes. His heroes at the time were the Brazilian Ronaldo, Zinedine Zidane, and Francesco Totti. And I think it speaks to the longevity, the frightened longevity of the latter, that he would actually go on to play with Francesco Totti in the twilight of his career. But his story, I mean, just from a logistical standpoint, stands out, because after joining a couple of local clubs, he got his first break joining the Academy of Arab Contractors, who are a team in the Egyptian Premier League. But they are based in Cairo, so with the transport issues, it was a 4.5 hour bus journey there and back that he had to make every training day, if you like, which completely compromised his education. So he's basically, his lifestyle is a 4.5 hour, two hours of school in the morning, 4 hour bus journey to training, somehow finding the energy to perform and train well, and then a 4.5 hour journey back before tea, then bed. So it was something. He actually had a form from school that said he was only permitted to attend 2 hours a day. So that was his sort of run, his journey through the academy. And in the academy, he was actually originally employed as a left back, while it is tempting to imagine what he could have been like as a rival to Robertson in that position, what actually happened is he would just go on regular maze of surgeon runs through the defence, and then get into the box and be so exhausted from his runs that he would just fluff his strikes. And this happened on such a regular basis that his youth coach found him one day crying because he'd missed so many chances from this position, and basically told him, actually gave him 25 Egyptian pounds, told him not to worry about it, he's going to move him to right wing and he's going to be the top scorer in the division. That youth season, he got 35 goals and never really looked back. So within a matter of years, he's broke into the first team in Egypt and had a few impressive seasons there before he got his break in Europe with Basel, which came about because Basel actually played a friendly with Egypt under 23s, which he was then a part of, and he scored a brace against Basel. So that was his sort of introduction into Europe. While he made a bit of a slow start in Basel, but eventually he sort of became an integral part of the team that were to win their fourth consecutive Swiss title. But it was his performances in Europe, particularly against Jose Mourinho's Chelsea, which would change everything. Over two legs, this was in his second season in the Champions League group stage, he was to score an opening goal in what was a 2-1 win. And then at Stamford Bridge in the return fixture, he scored the all important goal to completely infuriate Mourinho. And although Basel would go out in the group stages nonetheless of the Champions League that year, he would be within January that season signing for Chelsea and going from being Mourinho's tormentor to a member of a squad competing for the Premier League. While that was obviously his big break, he had actually turned down interest from Liverpool. So there's a sliding doors moment there where you wonder whether that would have, you know, whether that decision has delayed his ascendancy to the top of the game. But I'm sure he's not too bothered at this point in his career. Like many stars of the future in that Chelsea team, he was kind of lost in the shuffle in the same way as Kevin De Bruyne and Romelu Lukaku and endless others that kind of couldn't break through the established stars of the day and found their playing time limited. There were some promising moments in that first season, goals against Arsenal and Stoke, But as his time at Chelsea went on, he featured less. And when he did feature, he looked less confident. He became more ineffectual. And there was really little fanfare or surprise when he did leave the following January. What was thought to be an 18-month loan for Fiorentina, where he was actually making a deal for Juan Cuadrado going the other way to Chelsea. But it was an absolute perfect fit for him at Fiorentina. They are a team that know that have a romantic sort of history of taking great attacking players to their hearts. And in 6 months, he became a bit of a cult hero. He scored a decisive winner against Inter in the San Siro. He scored some key goals in Europe, and he scored a really feel-good brace against the bitter enemy Juventus in the Coppa Italia semi-finals. Although that did result, they didn't end up triumphing because of a second leg defeat. But that was the sort of first time you could see the shades of what the player Salah would eventually become. Like many of Fiorentina's sort of heroes of the past, certainly striking heroes from your Baggios to Batistutas, he would break their hearts and seek a move within 6 months. While it would be, you know, excessive to put him on a level, you know, his legacy on a level with those two, you know, genuine greats of the club, it was still a really bone of contention, which actually ended up in the courts, as they thought they had an 18-month deal with Chelsea. Salah believed he was free to leave. In the end, he was free to leave, and he ended up joining Roma, where that's where he would link up with one of his childhood heroes, Francesco Totti, along with a great team, a great attack with like Edin Dzeko in there. Obviously, he still had Daniel De Rossi close to the peak of his powers. He enjoyed two brilliant seasons at Roma. He scored 35 goals over two seasons. He was pretty much with Totti age, and he was the undeniable sort of talisman of that team that finished. They had two top three finishes in Serie A, and he contributed consistently with European runs and was just the main man in that team. Nevertheless, when Liverpool did sign him for 37 million, because of his previous time in Chelsea, it was seen to be a risky move. It was scrutinised, the price fee was scrutinised, but within months of that season, it seemed to be like the bargain of the century, as he just scored. I mean, even at his standards, it was such a free scoring campaign. He ended up breaking Alan Shearer's record for most goals in a 20-team Premier League season, scoring 32, as well as being the sort of main figure in Liverpool's run to the Champions League final. He scored brace against Roma in the semis, so breaking the hearts of his former club once more, before it all came tumbling down thanks to a cynical Sergio Ramos takedown in the final, and they were ultimately defeated. But since then, he's only gone from strength to strength, and Salah's, you know, been at the heart of the Champions League, got revenge the following year, scoring the opening penalty against Spurs in the final, and then eventually being at the heart of the team that would end Liverpool's 30-year title drought. If anything, he's arguably going from strength. If anything, he's arguably at the peak of his powers now, playing the best football of his career. And in terms of his legacy in Egypt, although he has suffered heartbreak in numerous fights, particularly recently as well, against his strike partner Mane, he's an absolute icon in his. And basically a symbol of what you can achieve as a sportsman in Egypt. In terms of what he's done to tackle poverty in his hometown, he has, during the COVID crisis, he basically funded an ambulance centre in the Greek when sort of death rates were peaking and the pandemic was at its worst. In terms of to tackle the limited education, he also funded the building of a girls' school, an all-girls school in the Greek. And there's been countless sort of examples of, I don't know if you call it generosity or examples of attempting to improve the conditions for his local community. So overall, a legend on and off the pitch.
There we have it, Paul. Mo Salah, a legend.
I can't really disagree with that, can I? I think James made the case there really eloquently, and I'd come across as a right sourpuss if I disagree with any of that. I think the two questions really from all this. One, why did he not fit in at Chelsea? I mean, that's kind of a story in itself, investigating as to why Mourinho didn't appreciate his talent, because quite obviously he had the talent. So how that was missed, or whether, you know, Mourinho was too reliant on the old guard there and didn't want to develop Salah and bring him through, I don't know. And you touched upon it as well, James. I mean, on the international stage, he's had a fabulous club career. But, you know, in terms of an international legacy, he hasn't really left one at the moment, I don't think. And, you know, you could take the view that to really establish yourself as one of the leading figures in the game, you need to have a couple World Cups under your belt and make some progress. I mean, you know, as you know, Ronaldo and Messi have two of them to the extent. So, but yeah, I mean, one of the things I was impressed about Salah is how he always seems to avoid getting injured. And I think his fitness record for somebody at that level, it's usually impressive. And if I had one criticism, I just think sometimes when he's in possession in the box, he goes down way too easily and wins way too many penalties for Liverpool that in another era would not have been given.
Something of a sore point there, I think. Gary, Gary, your thoughts on Salah, the man who didn't make it at Chelsea?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Paul and James made good points. I mean, the issue with Chelsea, when he was at Chelsea, was never really interested in anything other than the first team and the players who were competing for the first team. And Salah was far from the finished article when he came to Chelsea, far from it. He was a player who'd starred for a fairly mediocre European team. And I, you know, he's not the sort of player that Mourinho is interested in buying. He's not interested in 2 years development of players. And as James mentioned, when he went to Fiorentina and then on to Roma, it was like a finishing school for him. And he was a much better player when he came, when he left Fiorentina. And he was an even better player when he left Roma. And, you know, he's as, you know, all managers have got these sort of players that they're the sort of players that they like and fit into their sort of structure of a team. And Salah for Klopp is like hand in the glove. He's the perfect player for him. It's a fascinating situation at the moment. I mean, this guy is now, I think he's 30, and he's looking for, you know, probably his last big contract. And, you know, there's who knows how true this is, but you know, gossip in the papers, you know, they're talking £400,000 a week, sort of thing. It's an interesting thing, you know, when players get to that sort of 30, 31, they tend to have to change the way they play because the explosive pace begins to diminish a little bit. The reactions tend to diminish, and they might need to rely more on guile and experience. And Shearer was a classic example of this, Aiden, when he had his injuries, that he had to change the way he Gary Lineker very much the same as well. So it'd be interesting to see how sort of Liverpool approach the issue with Salah's new contract. I mean, the science Diaz, who looks like another exceptional player as well. But, you know, I think it's difficult to say that Salah, over the past 2 or 3 years, hasn't been in contention of being in the top 3 or 4 players in the world. You know, and Chelsea got rid of him for peanuts. Nice, Jose.
Well, Chelsea have done all right, let's be honest, Gary.
We don't have to. That's true. And Gabs has a good point as well. At the same sort of time, we signed De Bruyne from Genk, Lukaku came from Anderlecht, and there were players that both the same situation, well, not the same situation, but there was of a similar stage of development. They needed somebody to develop them, put their arm around them, and tell them they belonged. And Mourinho ain't that guy. He ain't that guy. And you know, they moved on to other clubs and prospered there.
Now, James, have players like Salah and Mane, Drogba, Beto, Weah, over the last 2-3 decades, have they essentially transcended African football, if you get my meaning? Are they simply now world football stars rather than African football stars?
I think definitely the players you mentioned there, yeah, they've transcended it. They are world football stars. I keep going back to Roger Miller, but as he was the sort of the mainstream pioneer on the world stage, if you think of what the mentality would have been around, it was the African star, the goal scorer, the Cameroonian star, and it was very much about the continent and the country that he was representing, and it being a story within itself. But such as their achievements been, and how much they've just been a part of the European game and top level European football. I think certainly maybe you could say Weah being not too far removed from the original, you know, burst of Pelé and Miller and stuff. Maybe you could say that there was still a real connection in the sort of general public consciousness with where he was from. But now when the likes of Drogba and Eto'o and players like that, of course, they're proud representations of how, you know, the brilliance of what African forwards and footballers can be. But I don't think it necessarily crosses the mind of anyone other than that they're just great players in the European game.
And Paul, are African players now therefore European products, essentially? You know, we talked about people who've struggled their way through various African lower leagues and so on to get through. But in the modern day, with the power, the financial power of Europe, European clubs and the scouting regimes and so on, are these players increasingly European products, European developments, and therefore maybe losing a bit of the sort of free-spirited style that James mentioned a while back?
Yeah, it's a really, really debatable point, that one, I think, Aidan. I think undoubtedly now, because the academy systems are so embedded in European teams and the recruitment network is across all five continents now, that these players at an early age are identified and then inculcated into the European lifestyle, so they have no problems with adaptation to the pressures of playing in one of the major European leagues. So yeah, I think the days of someone like Abede Pelé moving around from country to country, trying to establish himself, writing a few letters to agents in France to try and get a trial, I think those days have gone. And in some ways, that's good. But also, in terms of romanticism, you do kind of miss that, the guy who's grown up in the back streets and has kicked his way to the top of the world game. And I think increasingly so, as clubs like Man City, for example, build their partnership across five continents and establish partnerships with other clubs in Africa and almost cream off the best talent. And I think the bigger concern for me is, as we kind of found with the academy system in the UK, is that, lots of people get discarded by the academy system. The fallout rate is pretty horrendous at times. I remember reading a heartbreaking story about in Turkey at the end of every season, African players who've gone over there who haven't made it have a trial match at the end of the season, desperate to be picked up by somebody to stay in Turkey to try and keep the European dream alive. So there is kind of that complication to it as well. But yeah, I think football is increasingly a world game. And I think one of the byproducts of that is that players are spotted at a very early age, developed at a very early age. And the days of someone coming through from the shanty towns, passing under the radar, I think it's just gone.
Okay, then what about the future, Gary, future for African football? I guess in World Cup terms, we recall Pelé's grand prediction of a few decades ago of an African World Cup winner by the year 2000, which clearly didn't happen. No, they did win the Olympic Games twice by then, Nigeria in 96, Cameroon 4 years later. But in the World Cup, it's been three quarterfinalists, as we mentioned, but no further. What does the future hold, do you think?
Good question. I mean, we go back to, quarterfinals in our father. If Luis Suarez hadn't punched that one off the line in South Africa against Ghana and Asamoah Gyan hadn't fired the penalty over the bar, the Ghana would have been performance and deservedly so. I don't know. It's difficult. It's difficult. I think one of the problems is that, as we're talking about the academies, a lot of countries have set up academies. Clubs set up academies in Africa, and so you're in the same sort of situation. You see so many players in England and across Europe, where 2% get through, so therefore 98% get discarded. And it's interesting. We've talked about players such as Drogba, it happened to Abede Pelé as well, and Salah to some extent as well, who got so far then got cast aside at various parts of their career and had to have that sort of commitment, dedication, that belief, that self-belief to sort of know that you are good enough. And it must be difficult, especially when, you come to a different continent, to have that sort of belief and just to be steadfast about it. I just wonder how many... I think the problem is the academy systems that clubs have that set up in Africa produce a small quantity of quality rather than a broad base of policy. So you'll have, and you're talking about, if I said to you today, you know, okay, Mo Salah plays for Egypt, name me four other Egypt players. I mean, I'd struggle. I mean, you could say the same with Senegal, with Mo Salah, although with Sadio Mane, although I'd put Edward Mendy in there, obviously, as well. But I think what we've got is a number of star players, but not that sort of great spread of star players like, you know, we have in South America. You know, you have Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil. They have massive amounts of star players. So I think that the difficulty is that perhaps the production line of players coming out of Africa concentrates more on the stars and less on the sort of the very good rather than the exceptional. And I think it'll be a distance before that change. And unless it changes, World Cup success will always be, I think, a difficult stretch. I mean, I hope I'm wrong, because, you know, the world game will prosper when more continents, I mean, as well as Africa, obviously Asia as well, get more successful. But I think it might not happen in the near future.
Okay, well, we will see. But we'll have a couple of quick fire rounds here to finish things off before we call it a day. So, firstly, for each of you, from the list of players in this magazine, well, hopefully from this list of players in the magazine, I want each of you to tell me who you would class as the most iconic African forward of all time. So hopefully it is one in the magazine. James, how about you?
That's interesting. I'm torn between two, but I was going to say George Weah winning the World Player of the Year, but I'm going to go Samuel Eto'o just because of the sheer volume, like depth of his achievements in the club game. He won two trebles with, you know, one under Guardiola with Barcelona, and then he went with Mourinho and did it again with Inter Milan. I think he was the player that just remained at the top, the very top of the game for as long, if not longer, than any other player in the magazine. His achievements, I think, I wouldn't know this without checking, but I would imagine that they're probably, in terms of his honours in the game, higher than anyone else in the magazine. He played in two of the best, he was a major player in two of the best club teams of my lifetime. And I think the story of him sort of being cast aside for Ibrahimovic, being a make-weight in a deal, of a club where he'd been a legend, sort of getting on with the Mourinho bitterness trail and being perfectly inspired by that sort of feeling a bit disrespected and being part of one of the most unlikely trebles in recent years is something to, it's something to say. And yeah, overall, I think if we're talking iconic in terms of their legacy on how they changed the attitudes of African football and the perceptions, then maybe he's too recent to have really to own that legacy. So I'm just going to go with his achievements on the pitch and give Eto'o his props, especially since we haven't talked about him in this.
Well, absolutely, yeah, spot on, right? Good enough. How about you then, Paul?
I thought Gary made a hugely convincing case for Didier Drogba, both in terms of influence on the pitch and off the pitch as well. And I think, if you're talking in terms of a calling, such as the term of greatness on footballers, I'm always drawn to all players who have made an impact both in the sporting sense and the societal sense as well, and someone who's made a legacy and an impact on their own country that's influenced generations of people coming through to follow their path. So to me, Didier Drogba.
Very good. Okay, Gary. Well, you usually pick more than one on these occasions, and if you could avoid Eto'o and Drogba, that would be some achievement now.
Yeah. Probably not going to happen, though, is it really? I mean, honourable mention for Eto'o and, you know, George Weah especially as well, you know, for entirely the reasons that James mentioned. But, you know, I suppose I'd have to go with Drogba. But, I mean, not because he was a former Chelsea player, but because he's Didier Drogba.
Yeah. Oh, no, fair enough. Yeah, we can make sure there's no Chelsea bias in these answers when you're talking about Drogba here. The attributes we're talking about are not Chelsea-specific in any way.
Correct.
Now, okay, well, we've not had time to discuss all of the great players in this magazine. So the likes of Eto'o that James was mentioning there, George Weah, Magier, many more. some truly significant names of the game, some magnificent players, of course. Now, after each of you have marvelled at the artwork alongside your own articles when the magazine lands, which other article will you be heading for, James?
To be honest, I think I'm just looking through the list again because there's some absolutely exceptional ones in there. But I think that a Berry Pelé one will be really exciting to read. I think having my top main reference point knowledge is of his career is his great time in Marseille in that that holy trinity of attacks with Papin and Waddle, and then with another one with Boxic and Rudy Voller. So the actual story in his and how he got there is something that before this podcast I knew very little about, and I'm very excited to read more.
Fantastic. And how about you, Paul?
Yeah, I think I would. And your story outline before there, Aidan, about Kalusha Bawala. I'm unfamiliar with this guy, so I really want you've really given me an interest to find out more about some of his achievements, and particularly the potential that Zambia team never quite fulfilled his potential for it in those tragic circumstances. But one article I'm looking forward to reading, Benny McCarthy, purely because I like the history of players who came through in South Africa after the apartheid era had ended, because I think their path to football and success is slightly different from paths to football and success in other African nations, because I think that's a real classic example of having to overcome prejudice and perceptions to make it at the top level. I'm quite fascinated to be Benny McCarthy.
Interesting. Excellent. Okay, and Gary, finally?
Well, I tend to go off to stories first for one of two separate reasons. So, I mean, firstly, the players I don't know much about, all the stories I don't know much about. I mean, players in this case, but generally stories if you go to the clubs or whatever. So, I mean, these ones, I mean, like, we're all there. It's a good example. Osama San, Sam Keita, Rashidi Yakini, whatever, my chair. I don't know much about them, so I'll go to them. But because of my sort of interest in football and sort of politics, they're that intertwined. George Weah is the one I should probably start with.
No, magnificent. Well, I'll pick Rabah Madje, so you don't have to, Gary, because he's obviously a significant World Cup player from the past, but, you know, major breakthrough at the time of 1992, but I don't know that much about him. So that'll be another fascinating one to get into. Well, that'll wrap us up for this evening. Well, thank you all for your contributions on all things African forwards. It's been magnificent chat. So I hope you've all enjoyed it too. James, thank you very much for being on again.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's always a pleasure to be on. It's nice to branch out from something non-Leeds United related now. I look forward to you having me back sometime soon.
Excellent. Can't promise it won't be Leeds misery, though.
Fair enough.
And you, Paul, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ed. This has been one of the most enjoyable podcasts I've been on, because there's been a range of topics, like talking about people we know, George Weah, Mo Salah, etc., and also getting into the background of players we don't know so well from that exhaustive list you mentioned at the start there. So, you know, it's given me things to go back to look at in the magazine. And I think we broadened the conversation as well into, you know, this whole debate about African football. How does African football go on to succeed at World Cup level? But also the Europeanization of the academy system in Africa and what the long term consequence of that going to be as well. So, fascinating as ever. Great. Always enjoyed listening to James and Gabby with their insights into these players. And thanks to you for hosting immaculately again, Aidan. It's always a pleasure to be on the show with you.
Too kind, Paul. Too kind. And thank you very much, Gary, as well.
Yeah, terrific fun. It's always great to be talking about football with my mates. And the magazine's going to be great. And I can't wait to get out to Mark. The trouble is that my copy tends to be stuck in the UK for 6 months before I get older. So I'm always jealous when you guys put pictures on Twitter with you. Oh, I've got my mag. Curses. But it's like Christmas when I get there, and there's five or six. So I'll be looking forward to getting hold of this one. And I would only recommend anybody who's thinking of buying, don't hesitate, guys, because this one will fly out.
It will. It's sure to. So, yeah, so it is your reminder, your final reminder to everyone listening. This African magazine will be released on the 9th of May. As Gary's alluding to there, it is sure to sell out quickly. So act fast if you don't want to miss out. It's going to be a truly wonderful magazine, a venture into a continent with so many great footballing stories and great iconic players. So that is your reminder. Do not forget to get yourself on that. So thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the pod, and we'll also enjoy the magazine too when it lands. And do join us again next time on the Lob podcast with East Football Times. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.